Our third presentation will be given by the equally beloved Mr. Pavlos Kimisis, Professor of Behavioral Sciences, Psychiatry and Pediatrics. To put it more simply, I would call him a child psychiatrist at New York Medical College. He is also director of another psychiatric department at a center for children called Children's Village. His studies are distinguished by their excellent approach to psychology and their skillful application of it, at least in the books of his that I have read, while they never depart in the slightest. From scientific principles, they nevertheless explain what he wishes to say in a way that any reader can easily understand. He is well known in Cyprus, however, so I will say no more. He will approach the writings of St. Joseph the Hesychast from the perspective of psychology. You have the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Your Eminence, Your Graces, Holy Abbots, beloved brothers and friends. Since we are speaking about ascesis or ascetic discipline, I know that I am the final speaker before lunch. Of course, the previous speaker reminded us that we are in a hotel with many comforts, but low blood sugar is nevertheless a temptation, and I ask you to fight it for the next 20 minutes. And listen to a few thoughts I would like to share with you on this subject. I stand at this podium with mixed feelings. Among the distinguished speakers at this conference, I may be one of the few who is not a theologian, monk, or clergyman. Or perhaps I am the only one who comes from the natural sciences. For this reason, my competence to speak about the life and experiences of Saint Joseph the Hesychast is limited. Several fellow psychiatrists in Greece put forward theories and positions concerning St. Joseph some years ago. Nor did they stop there. They went on to propose theories about the experiences of the ascetics and saints of the Church and to express opinions about noetic prayer. That raised serious questions and called for an answer. I therefore hesitate to speak, yet at the same time I cannot remain silent. Taking courage also from the encouragement and blessing of Elder Ephraim, I ask you to allow me, as one who is not a theologian, to offer a few thoughts concerning the spiritual experiences of St. Joseph the Hesychast. The relationship between psychiatry and religion has passed through various phases, shaped chiefly by changes and developments within psychiatry. At the end of the 19th century, Freud, seeking a scientific basis for understanding mental disorders, formulated psychoanalytic theory. Many took this theory to be a proven scientific fact and extended it to the interpretation of a great many phenomena of life. In his book, The Future of an Illusion, Freud attempted, in the name of a theory that merely appears scientific, to describe religion as an illusion. Today, we find ourselves in an age of dialogue between psychiatry and religion. This dialogue can be constructive provided that one fundamental condition is observed. Science investigates and describes the natural world, which is governed by natural laws, while religious faith belongs to the realm of the supernatural, where natural laws do not apply. Science is born from humanity's hunger and thirst to know ourselves, our surroundings, and the world. It is based on observation and experiment. It relies on mathematics, geometry, and physics. It uses the method of abstraction to understand various phenomena. Despite the progress of scientific research, the world and creation remain a mystery. In the Orthodox Christian tradition, faith does not depend upon human research and methodology, but is the simple acceptance of God's revelation. A contemporary American psychiatrist, M. Scott Peck, known for his work on the relationship between faith and psychiatry, wonders whether the most important question in the life of modern man is whether one takes one's faith seriously. The science of psychiatry uses various frameworks or models to understand human behavior. These include the biological, social, behavioral, existential, socio-psychological, and most recently, biopsychosocial models. We are still unable to say with certainty which model is the most scientifically accurate. For practical and functional reasons, however, we use one or more of them as a frame of reference for psychiatric diagnosis and therapeutic intervention. One of the most important developments in psychiatry has been its transformation into a scientific discipline, placing it among the sciences governed by commonly accepted scientific standards. The age of conjectures, unproven theories, and dogmatic subjective impressions has passed. At many universities today, psychiatry has been renamed behavioral sciences. At this point, we must emphasize the distinction between true science and pseudoscience. True science knows what it knows, while at the same time acknowledging what it does not know. Part of knowledge is the recognition of our lack of knowledge, accepting and acknowledging the limits of what can be known, the limits that distinguish natural knowledge from supernatural knowledge. Because Socrates accepted this, he was called the wisest of all the Greeks of his time, on account of his famous confession, "I know one thing, that I know nothing." Theology rests upon faith, which transcends reason and is the evidence of things not seen. It is therefore, by definition, beyond scientific knowledge and proof. Man's insistence on explaining doctrine by scientific methods and rational proof forms the basis of heresy. How can the scientific method use mathematical, geometric, or physical models to interpret the events described in the Bible and the experiences of God's presence in the lives of the saints? The temptation to use scientific knowledge as the ultimate and sole criterion for interpreting every phenomenon has always been present throughout history. From the earliest centuries, the Church encountered Gnosticism, which attempted to interpret doctrine through reason and knowledge. Over the centuries, Gnosticism has appeared in many altered forms, and it remains present even today. I will not tire you by describing the many mutations of Gnosticism, but I ask you to allow me to dwell on one that is related to this conference, the phenomenon of Barlaamism, or if you prefer, Neo-Barlaamism. In the 14th century, Barlaam, impressed by the Renaissance in the West, attempted to give a natural explanation for the experiences of the Hesychasts. He mockingly called them navel-gazers and claimed that whatever they saw was related only to natural phenomena arising from within themselves. St. Gregory Palamas came to the defense of the Hesychasts with his work The Triads in defense of those who practice sacred hesychasm. Palamas distinguished between God's essence, which cannot be participated in, and God's divine uncreated energies, through which man participates even bodily in the divine presence. The teachings of Palamas were confirmed by synods of the Church and constitute a fundamental teaching of the Orthodox tradition. It is a fact that modern science has advanced by leaps and bounds in every field, including the behavioral sciences. These advances include developments in diagnostic techniques, the decoding of the genetic code, and our understanding of how the nervous system and brain function. Yet, despite this astonishing progress, a large part of the body's functioning remains mysterious and unexplored. Some colleagues, impressed by the advance of knowledge and discovery, behave as though we already possess complete knowledge of everything. They remind me of the members of a United States commission at the end of the 19th century who, dazzled by the technological advances of their age, proposed that the Federal Office of Inventions and Discoveries be abolished because everything that could be discovered had already been discovered. Some fellow psychiatrists, dazzled by the brilliance of modern scientific discoveries, fall into the temptation of Neo-Barlaamism and try to interpret the spiritual experiences of the saints and Hesychasts according to pseudoscientific criteria. One such example of Neo-Barlaamism is a work by a colleague that has circulated in Greece in recent years. This work might not have deserved any attention or refutation, but because similar ideas are often heard, it is worth evaluating it briefly. I will not address every aspect of the book, which is riddled with scientific inaccuracies and subjective prejudices. I will not discuss at length how the book contradicts current knowledge, the author's view of LSD's therapeutic value, or what he always maintains to be the beneficial effects of hashish and marijuana. Nor will I discuss in detail his adoption of outdated theories about memories from within the womb, his claim that a person can supposedly remember events and circumstances from the time when he was still in his mother's womb. We know that the brain does not possess the maturity or capacity for such memories. The author goes on to formulate pseudoscientific conclusions and paranoid ideas about a supposed global conspiracy behind efforts to combat drugs. He even proposes treatments in which drugs supposedly assist in the analysis of the individual. This book suffers from a lack of seriousness, scientific credibility, and objectivity. The author claims that neuroses can be cured through the administration of hallucinogenic substances such as LSD. He even proposes extremely dangerous supposed treatments, such as using LSD to treat Gilles de la Tourette syndrome, childhood schizophrenia, and even childhood autism. It is well known that certain hallucinogenic substances, such as LSD, can cause symptoms observed in psychosis, including hallucinations and synesthesia. One user of such substances reported that visual hallucinations were accompanied by auditory hallucinations. He said, "I could hear the noise of the colors." After an initial feeling of temporary happiness, many users of hashish describe intense fears, thoughts of death, terrifying fantasies, and symptoms of psychosis. Such symptoms are experienced by people suffering from schizophrenia and include threats, accusations, fear, and terror that reaches the point of panic. The author of the book, however, goes even further. He relates this to his account of the psychology of ascetics and compares noetic prayer with Hindu methods of yoga and the Islamic mystical practice of dhikr. At one point, while describing the ascetics' upward movement, he attempts to draw parallels between the taking up of the prophet Elijah and the depiction of the Holy Spirit as a dove, and between Jacob's ladder and the ladder of John Climacus. He refers especially to Orthodox monasticism and to the life and experiences of St. Joseph the Hesychast. It is interesting to note that the author of this book chose St. Joseph as the foremost representative of modern Orthodox monasticism. He compares St. Joseph's spiritual experiences with those of Native Americans in the Ghost Dance religion and with those of the Eskimos. He even goes so far as to claim that the experiences of hashish users resemble those of ascetics engaged in noetic prayer. He attempts to connect sensory deprivation, which requires a fairly prolonged period to produce hallucinations, with the ascetic discipline of noetic prayer. St. Joseph writes, while describing an ascetic, or rather perhaps alluding to a personal experience, that as soon as he had said the Jesus prayer a few times, I was immediately caught up into Theoria Divine Vision. This shows that even after engaging in the Jesus prayer only briefly, without the long and prolonged process of sensory deprivation, the ascetic may experience grace. According to St. Joseph, the ascetic sees himself in profound peace and serenity of soul, in contrast to the dreadful and nightmarish experiences of drug users, which are accompanied by feelings of being crushed, trapped, eternally imprisoned, violently torn apart and buried in a grave. St. Joseph writes, as soon as I bowed my head toward my chest, I began to feel the sweetness brought by the Jesus prayer. The nous, the spiritual intellect, was caught up into Theoria, divine vision, and experienced serenity and boundless light. These are experiences that drug users cannot have. Regarding the experience of the uncreated light, our colleague again speaks of hallucinations and synesthesia resembling the effects of hallucinogenic substances. I will say no more, because it is clear that ideas of this kind represent nothing new. They are a mutated form of neo-Barlamism concealed beneath a pseudo-scientific veneer. Science investigates and describes the natural world, while the supernatural world lies beyond the reach of scientific methods and descriptions. That world moves in a fourth dimension which is founded upon faith and is the evidence of things not seen. I must acknowledge that there are natural phenomena such as the effects of hallucinogenic substances and psychotic syndromes in which people may experience various kinds of hallucinations. Likewise, under the influence of suggestion or an intense imagination, a person may experience visual, auditory, olfactory, or even tactile hallucinations. For this reason, centuries ago, Saint Gregory of Sinai warned his disciples, writing, "When you see a light or flame within you or outside you, do not accept it." The behavioral sciences have an important role in the evaluation and treatment of psychopathological phenomena. At the same time, however, they have neither the ability nor the right to insist on explaining with the finite means of science and reason phenomena that open onto the fourth dimension and pertain to faith. At this point, I would like to emphasize that the scientist's own subjective outlook comes into play. If he believes that there is another world not governed by the physical laws of nature, then he can accept that the experience of the saints is not a natural phenomenon, hallucinations arising from within man himself, but a manifestation of the presence of the divine uncreated energies. The scientist who insists on interpreting spiritual phenomena through reason and finite knowledge limits his own ability to see the world through the fourth dimension of faith. This brings to mind St. Gregory Palamas's description of secular learning as vain, harmful, and foolish when it does not accord with education and wisdom according to God. The well-known late professor and friend Father John Mayendorf, who devoted particular study to St. Gregory Palamas, refers to the chapters of St. Nilus of Sinai, which he believes were in fact written by Evagrius Ponticus. There we read, "When you pray, do not imagine the divinity or conceive of any forms, but allow yourself to draw near to the indescribable being, because true prayer is the rejection of all concepts. Repeating the Jesus prayer is not an exercise in autosuggestion, but a refusal to let the nous, the spiritual intellect, be scattered by endless words, fantasies, or complex ideas. Noetic prayer is not a kind of Christian yoga or meditation. The experience of light is not a product of the imagination, but a theophany like that on Mount Tabor, a fulfillment of the promise, 'I have given the glory.' The glory you gave me, I have given to my disciples, that they may be one as we are one." Elder Joseph writes in one of his letters, "Through prayer, human nature itself does not change, but grace transforms its properties through God's divine uncreated energies." Elsewhere, he adds, "Experiences of Theoria of Divine Vision follow one after another. They do not arise because a person creates fantasies in the nous, the spiritual intellect. They come of themselves. Man does not create them, they seize the nous and draw it into Theoria. I would be considered to be going beyond my field of expertise if I entered into the theological discussion of the divine uncreated energies. But as a psychiatrist, I would like to emphasize that the search for God is a profound existential need of the human person. The mystical poet Simeon, the new theologian, wrote, 'With tears I sought you, and behold, you appeared, the incomprehensible one.' The mystical experience does not have anything to do with any intellectual or mechanistic form of mysticism. Rather, it comes from beyond us as a gift and a spiritual endowment. Therefore, if we take our faith seriously, as Peck said, we must distinguish psychopathological conditions, phenomena caused by suggestion, and the effects of substance use from the spiritual gifts bestowed upon a person. If we take our faith seriously, then we must accept that Orthodox spirituality is not a human philosophy, but is directly connected with the doctrine of truth revealed by God. Modern psychiatric diagnosis uses 5 axes to classify an individual diagnostically. The first concerns the clinical diagnosis, the second personality, the third physical condition, the fourth sources of pressure and stress, and the fifth the individual's level of functioning. The fifth axis, despite its importance, is often overlooked. People who exhibit psychopathological symptoms cannot function effectively or produce worthwhile work in their lives. Someone who works successfully, has good relationships with others, and is creative cannot be described as suffering from a psychopathological condition. When John the Baptist sent his disciples to ask Jesus whether he was the one who was to come or whether they should wait for someone else, Jesus did not answer with mathematical proofs or logical arguments. He simply pointed to the evidence. Tell John what you see, the blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. So, to the question of who Elder Joseph was, it would be useful simply to describe his work, tell those fellow psychiatrists who, with their limited and impoverished reasoning and their pseudoscientific approach, sought to slander Elder Joseph, that as a result of his life and work, the desert became a city. More than half the present population of the Holy Mountain is connected with disciples of the Elder. Thousands of souls have been strengthened by his letters, his written legacy, dozens of monasteries have been founded, not only in Greece but also in faraway America. They bear witness to the Orthodox presence and prepare humanity for the difficult times ahead. And finally, the Elder sowed the mustard seed of the Kingdom of God, whose fruits we already see in our own days. Thank you. We thank Mr. Kimisis for his presentation and especially for the words with which he brought it to a close.